Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your host, Kevin Pelton, and it's been 25 years since the Seattle Supersonics reached the 1996 NBA Finals. To remember that team, we're joined today by the president and GM at the time, Wally Walker. Thanks for joining us, Wally.
Thanks, Kevin. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I mean, this was a really fun team to go back and research. It was a team that, you know, the last time I was here talking to you, we were talking about the 79 championship team and that, you know, how that came together. And that's a team I've only heard about secondhand. The 96 team, I was there as a season ticket holder. It was our first year having season tickets when they moved into Key Arena. But there was still a lot I didn't remember from that season, so it was interesting to go back.
Well, it was a fun season, and at the time we finished the regular season, of course, we had the 10th best record of all time in history. When the team has had a 10th best record of all time or anything close to that, they won the championship. And of course, that year we played a team in the finals that might have been the greatest team of all time, or that would have been a championship team just like the 79 team was.
Yeah, certainly a top-heavy season with some expansion that year, but yeah. I feel like the story starts in May of 95, much like that 79 team grew out of the disappointment of the 78 finals and losing game seven. You got to go back to the aftermath of losing in the first round as a favorite for the second consecutive year, the 1-8 historic upset in 94 against the Denver Nuggets, after which you came into the front office, and then 95 losing in the first round of the LA Lakers. And, you know, I went back and looked at the Seattle Times column saying the Sonics need to divorce. Steve Kelly's column saying Sonics, George Karl need to divorce. It was your call. Why ultimately did you decide to stick with George Karl as coach?
I thought he deserved another year with that group to see it through. Other part of the narrative that came through in that postseason was you have to get rid of either Sean or Gary. And I wasn't down with that at all. And I thought, you know, the core of that team, which was the head coach, the two young superstars, and then it was my job to try to fill in the other pieces and improve our chemistry. That was really the crux of our problem. We had terrible team chemistry. It really wasn't that great the year before, even though the team had had a great regular season, the best in the NBA. But that blew up in the first round of the playoffs, and the chemistry did. And it resulted in the loss to Denver. Then I'm doing the broadcast. You know, I'm traveling with the team part of the season, so I do have firsthand knowledge of what's going on the team bus, in the locker room. And it wasn't working. And then the 95 season was bizarre from a number of standpoints. One, we're playing in Tacoma, temporary building. And then we had the huge blow-up between George Karl and Kendall Gill that was public about Kendall thought he should be getting X minutes, said he was getting promised X number of minutes a game. And it just spiraled down from there in a very public fashion. So that was the worst of the chemistry issue, but that wasn't the only one.
Yeah. So one thing I think is forgotten is how good that 95 team actually was. Had the best point differential in the NBA that season, which is not something we thought of back then.
No, but when we won, we tend to kill people, blow them out. We were so athletic, and Kendall was part of that until he had to go on, be away from the team for mental health, really. Yeah. He was diagnosed with depression, but with him as the two guard, and then the rest of the cast, we were so athletic.
Yeah, and so that season, the Suns won the Pacific Division, finished two games ahead of you because they went 19-4 in games decided by 5 points or fewer, which unsustainably strong. Sonics were 10-9 in those games. So
we weren't a consistent outside shooting team.
Yep,
as good as we were winning the blowouts against the weaker teams because we were so athletic. When we got in a close game and needed a jump shot late, if Sam Perkins wasn't making it, we were hard-pressed oftentimes.
Yeah, and so the shooting was one of the first things you addressed along with that chemistry issue. It was obvious that Kendall Gill needed to be traded, and somehow you find a taker in the team that he came from, the Charlotte Hornets.
I remember getting the call from Alan Bristow, who I knew from way back from his days at Virginia Tech, and we played against each other in college, and he called and said they were interested in Kendall, and then we met face-to-face in Chicago during the pre-draft camp. And he said, we've got to keep this top secret because of some of the toxicity around Kendall still remaining in Charlotte, which he was willing to deal with, obviously. But I guess it had to do with Kendall's departure there. And Alan Bristow and Arne Tellem, who was Kendall's agent, had a blow up that was also public. So he said, this has to be top secret. And so we started the negotiation. We were talking to other teams because Kendall really had to go. Now, Kendall had a fairly large contract by those days' terms.
Yeah, 3.8 million.
Yeah, I know. And by today's terms, you would say, you know, what's the issue? That's, you know, minimum type contract. But no, and he had it for another 5 years remaining. So to find a taker, to take a contract at that time, the salary cap was in the low 20s. So that was a huge bite of anyone's salary cap to take it. So Charlotte was not a team that was a big spending team. So the fact they were interested, and of course they had a guy that we cared about, in Hersey Hawkins, and their contracts didn't quite match, but pretty close. But the big difference was Hersey just had 1 year remaining on his deal.
Yeah, and David Wingate makes up the difference.
Made up the difference. David Wingate was a guy that we didn't necessarily pursue, but Charlotte insisted that he be part of the deal, and we got lucky there because he was a great addition to our team in every respect, particularly on the chemistry front.
Yeah, ends up coming back at the end of his career to be part of the team, play one game basically as a locker room president.
And it was just wonderful with our guys. If he had to pick a most popular teammate, he would have won it.
But Hawkins, everything in that you kind of needed in that shooting guard in terms of the outside shooting, the steadiness, the leadership, in many ways, you know, as many great strengths as Kendall Gill brought to the table, in many ways his opposite.
In many ways, and a couple of things that we didn't appreciate scouting him and knowing him. He'd been an all-star previously in his time in Philadelphia, so we knew he was a really good player. But until you saw him every night, we didn't appreciate how good he was defensively because he wasn't a spectacular athlete. He was just, to your word, steady, but he never got picked. Kendall was just more athletic and a bigger guy, but he was always getting hung up on a screen. So when somebody gets picked that easily, it just puts all your other defense in a rotation, maybe sooner in a different, more defensive posture than we had with Hersey. He was just getting through the screen. So your defense was better shape right from the start. And he stayed in front of his guy. He wasn't making, you know, as many steals or blocking shots as say Kendall, but our defense was just so much more solid with him there. And Kendall was a good defender, but Hersey just took it to another level.
Yeah, an excellent disruptive team defender. But yeah, Hawkins, I think of the 98 series against Minnesota in particular, where he and Peyton switch matchups mid-round, and he takes on Stephon Marbury.
Yep.
So surprisingly nimble feet, I would say, I guess.
Good feet and just so smart, just knew every angle and anticipated so well. And then we didn't know him. So again, you have somebody day-to-day, you don't know really who he is. He had a great reputation, but then he turns out to be the all-time best guy too, and didn't need the ball. Now, on the slightly negative side, Hawk didn't report to us in the best shape.
Interesting.
He wasn't out of shape. He wasn't in terrible shape, but he really wasn't in playing shape. So I can remember seeing him in training camp. He was so stiff. He just was all bound up, and then he couldn't make his shots early on. We played a preseason game against the Lakers in Hawaii. Tough duty, but the general manager had to go for that. Hawk was 1 for 10. I think it was our first preseason game. Everyone's looking at me and looking around like, ooh, really? And then we start that season, by the way, 64-18. We started 6-5.
Yep.
Until we won a game in Minnesota. We had a 3-game road trip. I was on that trip. We lose it to Indiana. They were good. Then we go to Toronto, lose that to go to 6-5. We're going to Minnesota. You could not think we could be, not only could we end up at 500, that was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving in Minnesota. Our next two home games after we came home, the Friday after Thanksgiving, San Antonio, Sunday, the Chicago Bulls. So you're looking at the schedule, you're looking at your team not playing that well, but then there's one other twist to the story. The game in Minnesota was a really good win because we needed one after losing the first two on the road trip. In the second half, Gary Payton goes hard after a ball at midcourt and runs in hard to the signage that they had on the scoring table and twists his ankle. And so he's out for the rest of the game. It looks bad from the stands, but again, you go in and you talk to the Minnesota team doctor, and the Minnesota team doctor says, it's a bad one. Your doctor's going to want to look at it, of course, but I think it's at least a couple of weeks. Oh, no, here we go. We're going home. We got San Antonio and the Bulls and then the rest of the Western Conference, and we finally are above 500. So it's Thanksgiving afternoon. Talk to Dr. Zorn and Gary. Dr. Zorn said, it's a bad sprain, bad ankle. And so the usual things you ask, well, you know, how much damage could he do if he kept playing on it? Dr. Zorn said, well, I don't think it'll do more damage, but the pain will be so bad that he shouldn't play on it. That will affect him, and it will affect other things. Gary's response, I'm playing. What? What? No one, Dr. Zorn said, no one has ever played on an ankle like this. Gary said, I'm playing. And of course, he plays. No one knew he was really hurt that badly. We beat San Antonio. We beat the Bulls, and then we go.
Yeah, he figures pretty prominently in that win over the Bulls. But we'll get there.
Okay,
let's stay in the summer of '95.
Right. Okay,
did you have so that deal? As I recall, it got announced the day of the draft. Was that had you gotten it wrapped up beforehand, or was that just finalized then?
It was just finalized then. Charlotte was going through the flux. I can't remember the exact timing day to day, but Alan Bristow, who had done the deal as a general manager, then it turned the general manager reins over to Bob Bass. So Bob, at the end, was getting involved also. And Kendall had a visit to Charlotte. Again, this was all done on QT to go there. Well, I guess that was after the trade. That was for his physical. Kendall missed a plane. So, okay, you announce the trade, and then but the player always has to come see your doctors and pass a physical. Kendall misses plane from Chicago to Charlotte. So Bob Bass calls me, I can remember, and says, it doesn't look good. What are you talking about, Bob? What do you mean it doesn't look good? Well, he missed his plane. We got a PR issue. I said, since when is it a problem with NBA players, missing something in the offseason?
Right.
It happens, And, of course, Bob knew that. He'd been around forever. Whether he was trying to negotiate or not. Anyway, Kendall got on the next plane, got there, passed the physical, and the trade went through. But it wasn't without, some concern out here in Seattle, Washington.
For sure.
Anyway, it took a couple of weeks as we were, going through the process. There was a little financial finagling on who would pay part of the contract if it was traded, et cetera. So there's always some of that.
Yeah. So you draft then Sherelle Ford and Eric Snow. Yep. Snow acquired in a draft night trade. And then 4 days later or 5 days later, the NBA goes into the first lockout in league history,
yep,
which is not, I think, something people really remember, because this wasn't like the 98 lockout or 2011.
By the way, Sherelle Ford, who went nowhere, was my first pick as a general manager, first round pick. So it wasn't a good pick. And what I learned from that was you got to take the guy you're going to get blamed for if it doesn't work out. And the consensus in the draft room by our whole staff was to take Sherelle Ford. I want to take Donnie Marshall, but I want also to build a consensus amongst our group. And so, going forward then, for the next 6 years when I was the GM, I wanted the input, but ultimately it was my responsibility. So
you got to make the call.
You got to make the call.
So what is it like during that lockout period for you? Is you can't build your team the way that you kind of want to.
Right. In some ways, taking a break from that season was a good thing. I can remember George Carl even saying that, after the fact, that maybe we needed some time away given how bad the end of the season was. But, we had new players. We had the two rookies coming in, and then we made a trade, of course, to bring in Frank Bukowski. It was after that. But we had new players we wanted to get integrated into Seattle and the system. So that wasn't great. And again, we didn't know Hersey was not going to come in superb shape, but we would like to have he and Dave Wingate in much earlier, sure.
Yeah, so you mentioned that Bukowski trade. The lockout finally gets settled in mid-September, and within the week after that. Was that something you had been talking to Sacramento about, sending Sarunas Marshallonis and Byron Houston to Sacramento for Bukowski?
Yeah, we need another big man. Bob Weiss had coached Brick in San Antonio, so knew him well, knew his game well. And, of course, we all knew him some, but not nearly as well as Bob. Bob said, he'll give us a toughness. He'll make some shots. Now, Brick had a history of injuries, and he was hurt a lot. But he was in the last year of his deal. He signed a fairly large deal, again, by those day standards, in Sacramento. So we were getting a player that had all the motivation to be healthy. And, of course, you can't always control that, no matter what your motivation is. He had a skill set and a toughness that we needed.
Yeah, I think another presence that sort of helped shift the locker room and the roster in a positive way between those two seasons.
No doubt. And Brick had a presence about him, starting with some physicality. And then we can talk about it later when we get into the season, but he made the biggest shot of the year, which a lot of people haven't remembered.
Yeah, I mean, an all-time character in the league, I think, Frank Vrankowski.
All-time character, no doubt.
And
he's still mad at me for not re-signing him. By the way, after that, after the Western Conference run, he played 17 games after that. If he walked in here today, I'd say, Brick, how much per game should we pay you for those 17 games you played subsequent to leaving here? But he really helped us that season. There's no doubt about it.
I also remember him playing through a broken nose without a face mask during that season.
Yeah, right. I think he broke his nose in warm-ups. He was playing.
That sounds right.
One-on-one with somebody during warm-ups, broke his nose and said, I'm fine. I can go.
So one other thing that happened during that lockout period was the Sonics unveiled a new logo, changing from the Skyline, iconic Skyline logo, to a new look that included a different shade of green, included red. Was that a process that was in the works before you came in the previous offseason?
I can't say. I certainly didn't have any input on it. I can't say I disliked it at the time. But, you know, so I'm not throwing anybody on the bus here. But sports is about tradition and to kind of go a different direction. Now, there was a marketing reason for it. We were moving into the new building, and they had to choose colors for the new building. And so the kind of the red got into the logo and became a Sonic color, kind of that burnt red, which had never happened before. It had never been part of the tradition before.
Yeah, and stayed on the seats, I think, after the color scheme changed back in 2001 after the new ownership group.
That's right, I could remember.
Yeah, and lingered the Storm, I guess, was its legacy, where the Storm continued to have that red for a long period of time. But it also did feel like, even though that wasn't intentional timing, it was kind of like, given what's happened in the last two postseasons, change here is actually maybe not such a bad thing, despite the amazing memories associated with the green and gold in that Skyline logo.
Yeah. Well, I can remember George, who at times could be a little paranoid, but that's not uncommon in the coaching profession. But during the year we're playing in Tacoma, he said, well, the rumor on the street is new building, new logo, new coach. I said, come on, George. I don't necessarily think those things all go together. Just, you know, let's worry about winning some games. And we had a new building. We had a new logo. And we had the same coach. So that's how it went.
There you go. How involved were you in the opening of Key Arena that season?
Oh, only to the extent that I was there for the events. I had some input in the finishes of the locker room where people from ownership came to me and said, well, here's what we had in mind. What do you think? What do you think will work best for the players? And it was a really good home court.
I mean, that's that first season in particular, going 38-3 at Key Arena. So before the arena opens, on opening night, you'll play in Utah and lose by 18. What do you remember about that night?
Real concern. And of course Utah was great, and two of the greatest players of all time, but we had high expectations. We were planning to be a championship team. We had every reason to have that expectation, even after losing the first round for the previous 2 years. So for us to get killed in our first night, no, that was hand in glove with starting out just 6-5. We just hadn't come together at that point.
And then in the opening game at Key Arena, I believe the next night, beat the Lakers. Was there a little bit of demons exercise to beat them after the playoff loss?
My recollection is we just were so happy for a win. It had been a good rivalry for many years, going back to the medieval times when I played. So anytime you beat the Lakers, you enjoyed it. But coming off of a playoff series. But again, the important thing for us was get a home win in our new building. And it had a great energy to it from that first night.
Okay, now let's get to that game against Chicago, because I feel like that was a key moment in the season. As you mentioned, you know, kind of a rough start. Chicago, the opposite, obviously, had started 10-1 that season on route to the then record 72 wins, and come in on a Sunday night and you win that game. Gary Payton strips Michael Jordan in the final seconds of it to preserve the game. He shoots, I believe, 1 of 7 after halftime of that game defended by Payton. Was that an indication that, you know, we can play with anyone?
That really helped. And again, at that point, we were, I guess, 8-5 when we played them to go to 9-5. So we weren't overconfident about where we were, but to win that game against the Bulls being who they were with, you know, the job that was done on Michael, and to have beaten San Antonio, you know, the game prior to that, okay, maybe we have something here. And Hawk was starting to come around. He had a great game against San Antonio. He didn't have so much against the Bulls, but the previous game against San Antonio, I think, was his best game in the season to date. So, okay, the pieces look like they're fitting. And we had talent. We knew we had talent. It's just, are the pieces going to come together?
I was going to ask, obviously the Bulls that year, in addition to having a full season of Michael Jordan back in the 23, they added Dennis Rodman to that mix. Was he someone you had talked about acquiring at all?
No. Again, going back to our chemistry issue.
Yeah, that's a wild card.
That would have been really rolling the dice, because if we're worried about team chemistry, we had to take the drama down. And Dennis, listen, he's a Hall of Fame player, and he hurt us in the championship series. There's no doubt about it. But we didn't have a serious discussion about him coming here, no.
So I think the next key point in the season comes a couple weeks after that, when Detlef Schrempf suffers a non-displaced fracture of his lower left leg, diagnosis that he's going to be out 6 weeks. This is kind of a key test for a team that was not at that point in first in the Western Conference and, you know, relied heavily on Detlef, obviously.
Well, we haven't talked about Detlef, and he had been an all-star and was still all-star caliber player, and subsequently was an all-star and was certainly a vital cog. So, yeah, for him to go down, there was a little bit of a tendency internally still to say, oh, here we go again, like we're snake bit. Right. We got nothing but bad. The only luck we have is bad luck kind of thing. I hoped I helped some with that attitude, because you can't accept that attitude. You just got to do the next man up and go and approach it. And really, the coaches are managed day to day, so they get the credit for, hey, we'll somebody else will play and do the job, and that's exactly what happened.
You know, you think of that classic starting lineup that was obviously Schrempf, Kemp, Irvin Johnson in the front court, mm-hmm. Peyton and Hawkins in the back court. That group only started 46 games during the season.
Right? I didn't know the number was that low.
Yeah, it was 13 different starting lineups, and the other starting lineups had a 28-8 record, basically the same winning percentage as the starters who went 36-10. So you not only survived that Schrempf absence, but go on a 7-game winning streak without him starting in late December to move into first in the West and go 17-5 without Schrempf.
People don't talk as much about Vince Askew anymore. He was really a good defender, and this is not a negative about Detlef at all. It's just Vincent was exceptional. So when he played, and he was mostly playing the three-man, we were just an exceptional defensive team.
Yeah, and then also more three-guard lineups where you put, yes, when Nate McMillan was healthy, him absolutely out there with Peyton and Hawkins.
No, and the three-guard lineup, and Nate, unfortunately, as we'll probably get to, wasn't healthy for that series against the Bulls, but that was a hard lineup for people to deal with, and just as great defensively, great, tough, and smart defensively with Nate, Hawk, and Gary out there.
Yeah, I mean, a really modern lineup in some ways in terms of multiple ball handlers, guys who could switch, which you did a lot of. Even, you know, Bob Klockenberg was not part of the coaching staff anymore by that point, had gone to Denver, but still a lot of his DNA.
Oh, it was totally his system, the Kloppy system that George had adopted with Kloppy on his staff. And we were a hard matchup in the regular season because no one else was playing like that.
Right. So Schrempf comes back at the end of January, and then the team takes off again, a 14-game winning streak, one of the longest in franchise history. Anything stand out from that period? It was just kind of establishing yourself atop the West.
I have a recollection, not as much of a specific game, but in going to practice and seeing the guys just hanging out and laughing. And I can remember even Sean coming by. It's one day I was just standing there, which I did a lot of, just stand there. Gentlemen, just stand over there. And Sean come by and said,
that's something the general manager and the media have in common. Right, right. Just standing around. We don't get to do that anymore.
I did it really well, though. I don't know. Maybe, media does. Some do fine. But Sean coming by and saying, it's just too much fun. So the guy, the chemistry now was great. The pieces were fitting. And the guys were just enjoying each other. And, of course, winning contributes to that. But they go together.
Was that a factor in, you know, at this point, the NBA trade deadline wasn't as big a deal as it is now, where you kind of expect major deals mid-season, but the decision not to do anything with the roster?
Yeah, I can't remember even being tempted at the trade deadline that year. That we had a team that was working, and again, if you have enough talent and the chemistry is as good as we were seeing, then yeah, don't mess with it.
Yeah, that team was remarkably consistent. There was not a single transaction in season other than players going on and off the injured list.
That's unusual.
So let's jump ahead to the end of the regular season here. And this is something we discussed before we started this pod, is the last game of the season. Denver is out of the playoffs at this point, but still tormenting the Sonics in the first round somehow.
Yeah, and it's a game, again, we said that team had a 10th best record of all time. Had we won that game in Denver, it was meaningless. It wasn't important that we do that, but for the sake of history and posterity, we would have been inside the top 10 of all time by going 65-17. But the bigger issue was that Sean got in an altercation late in that game, got kicked out of the game in Denver, and suspended for the first playoff game. So again, if you're thinking recent Sonic history, as we were, because we were living it, and being out in the first round the previous 2 years, and now you're arguably your best player. Of course, it's he and Gary, we go back and forth, but your top front court guy is going to miss your first playoff game. You're worried. You cannot be worried.
And lo and behold, the Sonics go out and win game one of that series against Sacramento.
We played incredibly well and adjusted like we did when one of our guys was out during the regular season, as was mentioned. And so now we're feeling good. We're up 1-0. Our confidence is high. Sean's coming back. We play a Sunday afternoon game on national TV against Sacramento, who was, you know, a fine team, but one
500 team.
Yeah. But one, yeah, we'd be heavily favored in that situation, no matter where we're playing, but we were at home where we'd only lost 3 regular season games all year.
Yeah, and then instead lose game 2 of that series, go 4 of 15 from 3-point range. Kemp with 9 turnovers in his return to the lineup.
Yeah, it was a somber locker room afterwards, and I always went back in the coach's office, coach room, where there was a postmortem done on the game, and you know that was a depressed group. And I can still remember Terry Stotts saying, which helped put it in perspective, I think, for everybody. I know it helped me, saying, hey, it's not like we're not going to lose another playoff game. So here we are. We're 1-1. Let's deal with it.
And then a crucial game 3 heading down to Sacramento in that series. And a game that down 9 going into the fourth quarter. I think you mentioned down 8 with 5 minutes left in that game.
Yeah. Well, let me give you the prelude to that game. You come out before the game, and the Sacramento fans are there very early. They're lining the court. And you got, you know, cute little kids with Mitch Richmond jerseys with their hands around their necks, you know, calling us, you know, there'd be some 9-year-old, you know, calling the Sonics chokers. So that was the backdrop. So the pressure was enormous. And somewhere in the back of everybody's minds with still the previous 2 years. And here we were. We had to win a game in Sacramento or the season was over again. And there would be enormous consequences to that. So what happens? We go down 9. We're down 8 with 5 minutes to go. And the place, it was a wild arena at any time.
Yeah, Arco. And for context, this was their first playoff appearance in a decade.
Oh, I'd forgotten that fun fact. Okay, so we're down 8. And furthermore, at the 5-minute mark, down 8, Sean picks up his 5th foul. So Sean's going out of the game. In comes Frank Prakowski. The ball goes to Detlef in the low post. Brick spots up. Now, Brick, we acquired him from Sacramento, so he played there.
Technically didn't play there, so he missed the entire season.
He was on the Sacramento roster. Yeah. We made the trade with Sacramento. Good point. And he hits what I firmly believe was the biggest shot of that season, that great season. He hits a 3-pointer. Which he didn't take a lot of, but he was capable of, with 5 minutes left to cut the lead from 8 to 5.
Yeah, he was another of those pioneering stretch fives, along with Sam Perkins, that made that roster unique.
To that point, we're still down 5, and it's not like we're stopping them every stop, But Sam hits, the next hoop we hit is a three from Sam. And he was closely guarded, just made a great shot, which he made a lot of here. So you have six straight points from your two non-starting big men to give us a chance to win. We obviously won that game. And the addendum to the game is I went in the locker room, you know, pretty shortly after the game, as soon as I could get back there. And that was in a ebullient, loud locker room then, because mostly starting with relief that we found a way to win that game, because worst case now, at least we were going home to Seattle for a game five, which, as we know, we didn't need. But as soon as I walk in, Brick started screaming, "I need a raise. I need a raise. I deserve a raise," which everyone, including me, fell out laughing, because, you know, everyone also knew if he had hit that shot, it likely would have ended very differently.
Yeah, and then so close out the series in game four amidst an earthquake in Seattle that night.
Was about that, right.
The contest.
Right, yeah. And by the way, that game was just a dominant performance. I still have a great visual from my seat in the kind of the corner of one of those incredible lob passes from Gary to Sean, where Sean just kind of caught it with one hand and cocked it and threw it down. And so that was a fun win.
So that brings us to the Houston series against the Rockets, team that had won the last two championships. Mm-hmm. The heart of a champion, as Rudy Tomjanovich that's talked about after the 1995 title, which they had won in unprecedented
fashion. Chuckling because Rudy started his assistant coaching career when I played for the Rockets.
Oh.
Yeah. So he didn't sleep much as an assistant coach for Bill Fitch, but I still have a visual of him dragging through the airports when we flew commercial with him being up all night looking at video. Bill Video is known somewhat famously as Captain Video. Yes.
In an era where it was not as easy to compile video as it is today.
Exactly.
That's for certain. So, you know, that's a marquee series and a series that the Sonics had dominated. I mean, that was one of obviously the disappointments of the 94 and 95 playoff runs, is that Houston won those titles, never had to face the Sonics,
yep.
who had won nine consecutive games through the end of the 95-96 regular season and through that matchup in the second round of the playoffs, because Akeem Olajuwon just consistently struggled with George Karl's traps and his Kloppy traps, as you mentioned.
Yep. Well, they were a great team. Akeem, for as much difficulty as he had with the Sonic defense, was still Akeem Olajuwon.
Yeah.
And the weakness of the defense, and it wasn't that much weakness because of what we did, but during the regular season, it was particularly difficult because teams didn't have a chance to adjust or prepare. But large, skilled centers were still problematic because they could see over double teams or could score. We lost to the Knicks in Key Arena, one of our three losses that season. Patrick Ewing has 41 points. So we lost Indiana at home. I don't remember what Rick Smith's numbers were, but those big skilled centers gave that defense some trouble. But Houston was a team we still had a lot of confidence against.
Yeah, I mean, it was just the ability to double Olajuwon, who still, like you say, was a dominant force, and then get back out to shooters on a pretty good, effective basis. Game one of that series, in the second half, you outscored them 64-31 to blow open what had been a close game at that point. But that was atypical the rest of the series. Everything else was close. Game two, a shootout. Houston makes 13 threes. The Sonics, from that shorter line, because that was the second season it was moved in, 20 of 27, the highest three-point percentage in NBA playoff history with at least 25 three-point attempts. Do you remember anything from that game?
I don't remember the game specifically, but I remember a game, and it might have been that one because that fits with those shooting percentages, where Nate was just caught fire. And Kevin Calabro went off on just, you might be able to find what he said. I don't remember the exact words, but it was hysterical as he was trying to describe how hot Nate was.
Yeah, I have a memory of listening to that in the basement and listening to Calabro, because I think it was blacked out locally back in those days. That's another very different thing than it would be today. Nate went 5 of 5 from 3-point range off the bench in that game.
Well, we need to find out how Kevin described it, because I'm sure it's a broadcasting classic.
Backs in, double teamed, out to Nate for another three. And he got another one. Oh, McMillan is in a zone. He's in a different time, a different place, a different space. All I can see is white light, and that rim is as big as a manhole cover right now. He's having an out-of-body experience.
Game three, a tight win in Houston to go 3-0 in the series. And the Rockets, to their credit, they did show the heart of the champion, even down 3-0. Force overtime in game four on
Mother's Day.
A Sam Cassell three-pointer in the final 5 seconds to tie it. But then in overtime, it's basically all Sonics to complete that sweep over the two-time defending champs.
I have a recollection from that clinching game of Gary making a double clutch shot. In other words, he went up in the air. Someone went up right with him. He just hung double clutch and made it from about 17, 18 feet. And I think it was overtime. And I can remember thinking, okay, we're fine.
This is our night.
Yeah.
Or afternoon, as that one was played as well. So the benefit of that is you get a bunch of rest by sweeping that series. That ends on Sunday, May 12th. The San Antonio-Utah series, the opposite semifinal, concludes after Game 6. Utah wins it 4-2 on Thursday, May 16th. And then the conference finals, the Sonics and the Jazz, start on the Saturday afternoon, May 18th. The Jazz get less than 48 hours turnaround while you've been at home this entire time. And that's another one that ends up a lopsided second half. Sonics win game one of the Western Conference Finals, 102-71. Do you remember anything from that?
Well, we were just, you know, sometimes you can be off too long. And I think our main concern was we've been sitting around, you know, maybe if you're playing well, playing every other day is just fine. But doing what the Jazz had to do, which is traveling after playing in a hard game within 48 hours, that's too close. So we just had fresh legs, and we were young and bouncy anyway. So that was way to our advantage.
And that series, I mean, to back up a second, Jazz Sonics, they'd always kind of been compared because of the point guard power forward duos, Stockton and Malone, and Utah, Payton and Kemp is kind of the newer age version of that in some ways. And Seattle had played them in 92 in George Karl's first year and lost in the second round, pretty dominant fashion by Utah, a little ahead of schedule for the Sonics at that point. 93, you play in the first round in a classic five-game series that the Jazz led comfortably at halftime of game five at the Coliseum before a second half comeback to the conference finals.
I was sitting in the broadcast booth. I was doing that game with Kevin on the Sonics broadcast. And I have a clear recollection of Sam just lining up threes and just watching Jerry Sloan just slump back in a bend every time Sam caught the ball with any kind of sliver of daylight, because we all knew what was going to happen.
That was also a comeback, I think, from 2-1 with the win in game four, must win, with Perkins making a big play. And I remember pointing at Mike Brown in that one. And
I do too.
Rare demonstration of emotion from Sam Perkins on the court. Yeah. But that all sets up this series in 96 with one of these two teams going to the NBA Finals for it would have been the first time in Jazz franchise history and the first time in 17 years for the Sonics. And it was a bit of a surprising matchup, I think, that Utah came out in some ways. You know, they, with San Antonio, Phoenix, Houston had been kind of at that upper echelon in the Western Conference. But they found something in those playoffs and really were you know, setting up the teams that got to the finals the next 2 years.
Yeah, and the guy who just made every open shot, in fact, I can remember talking to Scott Layden, the general manager for the Jazz after that series, and Brian Russell, we all want to call Byron because he spelled his name with a Y, but Brian Russell.
Yep, may have yelled that many times.
Yeah, right. made so many clutch jump shots, deep jump shots, threes, for a relatively unheralded player.
Yeah, I don't think he had started really during the regular season and then kind of moved into the lineup in the playoffs.
I remember talking to Scott to say, Brian Russell, you know, we're lucky to win this series with how well that guy played.
Yeah, and so it was a situation where you're up 3-1, game five at home, that one goes into overtime. There was a chance to kind of close out relatively early, but Utah ends up pulling that out in overtime and then dominates game six.
Yep.
So,
yeah, again, general managers don't always travel during the regular season, but we did for all the playoff games. And I can remember sitting there, I guess it was the Delta Center at that point, whatever it was, their home court.
Many names ago,
but whatever it was, whatever the arena was called, the Sonics faithful and the front office guys and the players and the coaches were all getting abused by the Jazz fans. That was the given.
Yeah, but that does set up a deciding game seven and one of the more memorable games in franchise history.
That was an all-time great NBA game, easy to say now that knowing we won it, but just sitting there to experience it, that was something.
And definitely a game that could have gone either way. And one of the key differences down the stretch, Sean Kemp making his free throws, Karl Malone didn't.
Yep.
Which has been coming to mind recently because everybody in Key Arena was chanting, you know, counting to 10 with Malone at the free throw line. And much as with Giannis during this year's playoffs, I think maybe not a full, you know, 1,001, 1,002 kind of thing. I think we might have rushed
fast counted. It's possible. It's possible. But we got the numbers right. I remember the fans that we were on top of that. But I can remember back-to-back post-ups, Sean on that left block, turn to the baseline. Mike Mathis, the same official, was a great NBA official, twice called Carl for ticking Sean on the elbow. Sean went and made all four free throws.
Sean Kemp with maybe the biggest free throw of his career to this point, right now. Second free throw up and in! Sean Kemp's free throw, putting Seattle on top, 89-86, 13 and 9, 10 seconds remaining in the game.
What I really remember is the steal and the dunk on Antoine Carr.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was an all-time for a close game, a pivotal play. I mean, Sean had so many great dunks, but that off 2 feet with Antoine Carr waiting for him was just an incredible display of power.
And that also may have been as loud as Key Arena ever got,
maybe,
I think.
Maybe.
That may have been the peak of it. And just the atmosphere in... I didn't go to that game. My brother was at that one. But from all descriptions, the atmosphere in Lower Queen Anne afterwards, because it was another Sunday afternoon game, and people pouring out to celebrate.
Yep. Well, it was for all of us. Whether you're inside or a fan, it was felt like a catharsis for putting all the kind of the bad memories of upsets the previous 2 years in the rearview mirror.
So now a relatively quick turnaround for that Chicago series, which started Wednesday. Do you think that kind of was a factor early in that series, the quicker turnaround, whereas Chicago had been able to close out Orlando in four, actually?
Well, it didn't help us. I couldn't necessarily point to that. It felt to me, of course, knowing our guys and watching all the games, that it took us a few games before we thought we belonged there.
Yeah.
And that was a little surprising because of what we've been through and, how good we'd been for months. But the Bulls were the Bulls, and we're going back there to play them in Chicago for those first two. I think this schedule, with the benefit of hindsight, I hope this doesn't sound like a rationalization because Bulls are going to be tough to beat no matter what. But the 2-3-2 format, I think, was not favorable to us or generally to the teams that don't have the home court.
Is the difficulty of winning all three of those games?
Correct. Difficulty coming home, and beating somebody as great as the Bulls, all three, which is not your only chance, but certainly your best chance of winning it all.
The other factor that's got talked about during the Last Dance last year when, finals kind of got rehashed is, so Friday night game in Chicago, Sunday game three at Key Arena, and the Bulls decide to stay over and fly out Saturday. George Karl decides to have the Sonics fly back Friday night, and he had to refuel, I believe.
We did. When the weather was colder, our plane was small, and if it was cold enough, the plane couldn't make it all the way from Chicago back without more fuel. We almost always flew back right after. If you're going home, you almost always flew back.
Right. That is the usual custom.
Yeah, no, right. And that's people get home sooner. That was the coach's call. And I don't think it was a reason we lost game three. Now, I'm coming from remembering my rookie year in Portland when we flew out after game four in Philadelphia. And getting in to Portland Airport at 5 a.m. So, and we won game six to win the championship on Sunday afternoon. So I witnessed that. So I'm not second-guessing that decision. It was just what it was.
Which was back under the original format, which we've gone back to now without the 2-3-2. Yeah. So you had more travel that way was the downside of it,
right.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the biggest factor in why the Bulls dominated game three was, they did have Michael Jordan and just the...
Well, but here's, and it speaks a little bit to, where we were vulnerable. Luke Longley, not a Hall of Fame All-Star center, has playoff career high that Sunday afternoon against us in Game 3. It's a little easier to accept if Pippen or Jordan or even Rodman beat you with a playoff career high. Luke Longley at a playoff career high against us. So, again, he had some skill, and he was 7-2. So when he was on, that hurt us.
And one thing that was a factor throughout that series was kind of injuries on both sides. You, I think, alluded to this earlier, but Nate McMillan, who is such a crucial part of the team, both on and off the court, dealing with back issues at that point that rendered him unable to play in some of the middle games of that series before he came back for Game 4, simultaneous to Chicago losing Ron Harper for a couple of games. And so that turned the tables for two lopsided Sonics victories in Games 4 and Games 5.
Yeah, I think it would be disingenuous to say if Nate were healthy the whole time, we would have beat the Chicago Bulls.
That's not going to stop me from saying
it. Well, we'll go with that then. but we could have. Not just because he was a really good player, but you referred to the intangibles. You just couldn't replace, even if he was over there on your bench, giving instructions, and he was a coach even then. Without him on the court, we were just not the same team.
And it was a great moment in Game 4. We talked about this with Nate on the History of Key Arena podcast I did a few years ago when that closed down. He comes back in Game 4. They're playing the song Return of the Mac, which has never been more perfectly suited. Crowd goes nuts and definitely helped spur on a blowout win.
Yeah. I had a interesting interaction after Game 3. Dick Ebersol, who was the famous head of NBC Sports, he and I ended up walking out to the parking lot from the tunnel and through the back entrance at about the same time, just heading out to our cars. Now, we were concerned about different things. We were down 3-0.
You both had incentive for the series.
Yeah,
to keep
I know.
Going.
We were both down 3-0. And, there's nothing fun about that, particularly in the context of how great our season had been. And Ebersol, who I liked, and I think was brilliant at his job, says to me on the way out, "Are you guys ever going to win a game in this series?" He's worried about NBC ratings. And I can't remember exactly what I said to Dick, but it's probably nothing I can repeat here on our podcast. But I didn't want to hear it. And again, I liked him. Anyway, that was his take. And of course we did come back to win in the next two. And really at point in Game 4 where we figured out we belong. We were a championship caliber team and we can beat these guys.
Sonics win for pride's sake, and the Chicago Bulls are sweepless in Seattle, baby. You know it. 107-86, the final. The Sonics defeat the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah, and obviously Peyton going on to Jordan famously helped. Make a difference defensively. Jordan struggled in those two games. The loss of Harper, the addition of McMillan, and then by Game 6, unfortunately, Nate goes back out, I think, midway through that game. It was just too much for him to play at that point.
And that was a good game. You can't say we were ever in control by any means, but it was a competitive game that shot here or there goes, or the opposite for them. Then, we got a Game 7, and then you get to a Game 7, and then the pressure for what they were under and how they've been discussed all year as the greatest team of all time could have been a factor.
Yeah, which is one thing we never saw from Chicago in any of those final runs, is them pushed to a Game 7.
Yeah. Going back to that last dance, of course, being provincial to Seattle, I took offense at they ran that clip of Bob Costas saying, and Seattle is, whatever, I'm paraphrasing, but is a prohibitive underdog. And of course, those of us who are following the Sonics know that we'd beaten Chicago in the preseason. We'd beaten them in the regular season. Now, they're 13 losses all year. We gave them 3. We weren't prohibitive underdogs. We were a great team that came up a little short.
Yeah, and just came up another against another great team. I mean, yeah. Is there, you know, it's not a championship, but is there some historical legacy for being part of that series and making the Bulls work as much as they did?
Well, right, as there is, and for because there's that whole special The Last Dance, and because they're revered, which came up again when Golden State had its, you know, its greatest years or year to compare their teams with the Bulls. I think the consensus, it feels like to me, is that still that 95-96 Bulls was the best team of all time. And the fact that we were there, and if not for that, whether they're the best team of all time or the second best, is really doesn't matter. The reality is, if we had just been playing another great Eastern Conference finalist, the Sonics would have been the championship team that year.
Yeah, yeah, it's all about timing.
Yeah.
Is it safe to assume that was your favorite season with the Sonics?
Yeah, when you're winning that many games, it works out. My favorite season in the front office, yes.
Yeah.
But there were some other contenders for different reasons. My favorite moment in all my years in the front office, which is 12 years, was when we went from a really bad moment, having to let Paul Westphal go as coach, and then the ownership gave me permission to choose who was going to succeed him. They rightfully asked me the night before, well, who's going to be the next coach? And I said, well, I think it's Nate, but I want to talk to both Nate and Dwayne. With your permission, after I talk to him tomorrow morning, can you allow me to make the decision on the spot based on those conversations? And they said, okay, so great. So I come in, give Paul the news. He goes, Nate comes in next. I said, Nate, and we made a coaching change, and we let Paul go, and you're a candidate to be the next head coach. They said, okay. I haven't been doing this that long, but I think I can do it. Then he said, but I think the next coach here should be Dwayne Casey. I said, what? Yeah, okay. I said, I'm going to talk to Dwayne too. I appreciate you saying that. So Dwayne comes in next. I sit down with Dwayne. And Dwayne says, you know, I've been here. At that point, Dwayne had been an assistant coach 5 years with us, really well prepared. And Dwayne said, I think I'm ready, but this job should be Nate McMillan's. So I called both of them into my office. Three of us sit there. And I started out the conversation by saying, okay, you guys both recommended the other guy for the job. Are you reading newspapers? Are you familiar with how much head coaches are getting paid in the NBA these days? It's more than you guys are making, more than assistant coaches. And I'm sitting there thinking, for all of the issues people talk about, athletes and, you know, it's all about money and, you know, make it while you can and all the cliches, here's two guys that have a chance to be a head coach in the NBA, and they're recommending their colleague, their buddy. So, you know, okay, that was a good moment, if I'm going to pick a moment.
And it turned out to be a great choice, as both of them have gone on to fabulous.
Right. Nate's going to be coach of the year, and of course he's in the playoffs now. Dwayne has been coach of the year. Dwayne made it easy for me as I was sitting there sorting it out. He said, I just didn't want recognition, like if I'm associate head coach or something like that, then I'll help Nate. So I said, okay, Nate, you're the head coach. Dwayne, your associate head coach. And Nate says, okay, what do I do next? I said, we've got practice in an hour. You're running practice. And we play Portland tomorrow night. So you're the head coach. Which, by the way, we went down and beat Portland, which had a really good team, the highest payroll in the NBA by 30 in Portland.
I think it was Portland and L.A. were the first two games, right? Am I recalling that correctly?
I went to Portland. I remember coming back and said, I haven't had that much fun in Portland since, you know, I played there and we won the championship.
I would guess 0405 is probably up there.
0405 was a fun season because we were not picked high. That chemistry came together, and Nate was the coach. And it was that season had some magic to it, too. We didn't have quite the level of talent to get to the finals, but to win a playoff series and to win our division, Sonics won the division only six times in their 41 years, which is not shabby, but that was one of them. So that was a fun, unexpected one.
Yeah. Well, I would be remiss while I have you to not talk about kind of the state of the group that you're part of, yeah. led by Chris Hansen, mm-hmm. Trying to build an arena in Soto, and then just how you're feeling right now about the chances of getting an NBA team, getting the Sonics back in Seattle in the near future.
Yeah, here's what I'm sure of. We Seattleites and Sonic Central folks do not have to sell the NBA on the idea that there should be an NBA franchise here. They fully believe that. I'm in consistent touch with the league office. They are completely on board with Seattle would be a great NBA market. They're respectful of the 41-year Sonic legacy here. They're probably, frankly, I don't say this, but probably, frankly, tired of hearing people complain about the factors now, but I'm glad they're hearing it because they do acknowledge it. But the NBA should be here. We know it. They know it. So we don't have to really make that pitch. Now, where it's going to be a competitive situation where we have to be fully prepared is the knowledge that whenever a franchise becomes available, there's going to be an owner involved. League's going to be involved too. But there's going to be a new owner involved with choosing the city and the economic model that he or she under which wants to operate that franchise. Well, we're going to be competing with Las Vegas and Louisville. Dan Issel calls me and says, you know, can we compare notes? I'm like, well, Dan, at some point we're going to be competing for, you know, a team. I like you, but, you know, yeah, let's stay in touch. Okay. Mexico City comes up a lot. I think they're a viable contender. The league would love to have a franchise in Mexico. So we have to have an economic program that works for an NBA team. Now, our group is fine. I think some people don't believe this, but I'm going to repeat it because it happens to be true. If NBA owner wants to be a tenant in the new building, the new hockey building at Seattle Center, if that's the choice, then great. Now, the recent trend is not to do that. The recent trend is to do what Steve Ballmer is doing, building his own arena in L.A., what the Warriors have done. The new owner in Brooklyn, you know, bought the building so he could own and operate the building as well. If an owner wants that model, then we're keeping our real estate in Soto to be ready for if that's the situation and an outcome that the NBA and that owner want. So we just have to be ready for all alternatives and provide them that opportunity for that prospective owner and for the NBA. It could be next year. Now, if you asked me 5 years ago, and maybe you did, I would have said we'd have a team in 5 years. And 5 years before that, I would have said we'll have a team in 5 years. So here we are. We'll get a team. It is when, not if, but maybe I should get out of the year forecasting business know that we'll have a team, I think, either at Seattle Center or a new arena, which would probably be Soto.
Maybe just set the bar higher than 5 years and eventually.
Maybe I will. Yeah, that'd be right. Well, the old adage about forecasting. You can forecast price, but don't forecast price and time.
Yeah.
Yeah, you pick one or the other.
Well, Wally, really appreciate the time. Always a pleasure, obviously.
Thanks, Kevin. Great talking to you. I really love the fact you do all the research and for people on your podcast, I hope they know how much you had to do with Jack Sekman getting in the Hall of Fame. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. But yeah. It was really just, emphasizing what Jack had done.
I know.
So.
But people forget. And you help remind them.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.